It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This episode of How to Win an Election is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the only major UK airport owned solely for community benefit. The airport is the major employer in the region, supporting more than 27,000 jobs, and its contribution to local charities are 20 times more per passenger than any other UK airport. To find out more about the UK's most socially impactful airport, visit lutonrising.org.uk.
Britain will win with podcasts. Strike up the band!
What is it about you and Liz Truss?
We used to get on.
Was that a yawn or a sigh?
You can put the bell away.
Danny thinks everything's noise.
I bet you owe the milk to Arthur.
We're all speechless here.
Yes, here we are again then. It's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm Matt Chorley, joined by new Labour mastermind Peter Mandelson, Polly McKenzie's Policy McKenzie, former Director of Policy for Nick Clegg, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. And if you like what you hear on the podcast, or you don't, and you want to get in touch, you can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. howtowin@thetimes.co.uk, or you can WhatsApp us 0333 003 2353. Send us a voice note, send us a question, let us know what you think about what is going on as we count down towards the election. How are we all? We're all in various parts of the world this week. Are we all well? Where are you, Peter?
I'm very well. I'm presently on Long Island near New York.
Very nice. Are you anywhere with so glamorous, Danny?
A pinner, yes, I am.
Polly, how are you?
I am in southeast London, and I don't think it's ever been described as glamorous. My house, no.
Well, only when you're there. Only when you're there. Now, we've got further evidence. We've got further evidence that senior Tories are listening to the podcast. A couple of weeks ago, as we know, Jeremy Hunt had been listening to the podcast because he raised Peter's comments about Keir Starmer's physique, which we won't dwell on again. But now it seems Rishi Sunak has been listening to the podcast and has finally done what you've been telling him to do for months now, that he needs to distance himself from Liz Truss. Let's take a listen to how he did that at PMQs last week.
When my predecessor was running for leader, to use his words, I did have the stomach to argue out loud about her economic policies, had the conviction to say that they were wrong. But not once, but twice, he tried to make his predecessor prime minister.
That's what you see now, referencing Keir Starmer trying to make Jeremy Corbyn prime minister. Danny, is it too late? Was it enough?
It wasn't enough. It's never too late to do something, but it would have been optimal to have done it earlier. The problem is that I wanted it. I think it's correct as a strategy to help define who he is, and I think that isn't really what he did. He answered the question, and it's interesting that he had to answer it in that way. When pressed on the issue of Liz Truss, he has to go down that route. So it begs the question, if that's the right use of that phrase, begs the question, whether he shouldn't have done this strategically in his own way, given that he's going to be forced into that position whenever he's pressed on the subject of Liz Truss.
What do you think, Polly? It wasn't the full-blown How to Win an Election strategy that we've been talking about almost every week since we started.
No, but he did make a good, solid and important point that he campaigned quite robustly against Liz Truss. And it's odd for him not to have made that point very strongly before. He's trying to say that that makes him a man of more integrity than Keir Starmer, because Keir Starmer campaigned for Jeremy Corbyn. And I'm not sure that stands up in the public eye as well, because of course Jeremy Corbyn didn't become the Prime Minister and didn't trash the economy and put everyone's mortgages up. So I think that the sort of the resonance of it just doesn't quite stick in the way he hopes.
I suppose, Peter, it comes to something when the thing that he said was the strongest words yet about Liz Truss, but by anybody else's standards, they were still quite tame.
They were tame, and I think if you blinked, you'd have missed them. I mean, most people wouldn't have registered that he said them. But I think the point about this is that he needed to, and I think probably still does, need to make a clean break from the recent Conservatives' past. He's just got to be something different. He's got to redefine himself, what the Conservative Party's purpose is now. After all these years in government, people want change. Now, we've been through this time and time again with his attempts in the past to try and be the change. I think that what he's got to do in approaching the election, whenever it comes, is to say, look, we got it wrong. We should have done this, that, and the other. We didn't. Now I represent something different, and this is what a re-election of the Tory government to a fifth term is going to represent and going to offer you. I think it's incredibly difficult and challenging to do that convincingly, but I think he's got to try.
There was a sweet spot. It's one day last week where his smoking bill had got through its first stage without a massive rebellion. There was quite a big rebellion, which we'll come on to, but it had got through nonetheless. The Rwanda bill was about to pass, which then it didn't quite, and it's back in the Lords again this week. Angela Rayner was all over the front pages. Inflation was coming down, and it almost looked for about 20 minutes like things might be. We talked something about green shoots, like things might just be starting to look okay for him. And then along comes Mark Menzies. And it just sort of, the Tory MP accused of taking money out of campaign funds to pay bad people and all of that. And then that just sort of smothers everything again, Polly. A whole like 2 or 3 days, so it's just all Tory sleaze
again. It's possible, Matt, that all of this live radio you do slightly distorts, you know, your perception of time. Because to normal people, right, like I don't know, that all just blurs into one, really, because people aren't paying attention minute by minute and like looking for how the story evolves. And you can imagine, yeah, Rishi Sunak similarly, because he pays probably as much attention to politics as you. We would like to hope so.
I mean, I would argue, I think about these things slightly more, because we've been saying for ages that he should have, what he should have been doing strategically.
Well, that's true. And you probably don't spend as much time fiddling with pivot tables in government data as he apparently does, but you know. you can imagine him feeling that glimmer of hope, but as Danny would say, right, like all of that is noise rather than signal. Signal emerges over weeks and months and not in the course of a live radio broadcast or even, God forbid, a podcast.
I think we're missing something more important about last week. Just to offer a postscript to what Polly said, and that is both in the case of smoking and sick notes, he was actually doing something. I think the problem with him and the whole government is that nobody knows what they're there for. What do they do? What's their agenda? What are their policies? In the case of smoking, like it or loathe it, it's an interesting and risky policy and probably on balance quite a good one for the country. And it also involved him taking on a large part of his party. You know, therefore, there seemed to be some point to Rishi Sunak. Similarly, the sick notes and welfare changes he wants to make. We can have a long debate about the merits and demerits, but at least he's doing something. And if he's going to keep on as Prime Minister leading this government from now until, you know, October or November, he's got to line up an enormous number more things to do so that people can see what he's there for.
Yeah, I do think on the... I think Polly correctly predicted my response to it. I do think it's really, really a mistake to try to follow these things with good news stories in a week. I mean, Peter will recall the 1997 election when I was working at Conservative Central Office, and he was running Labour's campaign, there were scarcely half a whole day where the Tory party got a good news agenda. And therefore, when we did get one, we tended to overestimate its importance. But as Polly correctly says, you know, people aren't following it that closely. And so, you know, it may surprise us, but people really don't know very much. Most people haven't noticed the Mark Menzies story at all, although it's so unusual that people possibly have noticed it more than the average.
Oh, come on, Danny. Like,
it's cleared the bar of my normal non-political friends texting me asking, how do you get a dog drunk? Do you know, are you the bad people? It's cleared that.
No, you're really, really overestimating people's attention. Sorry, I need to be sort of fairly strong on this. I agree that it's extraordinary for news, right? But that assumes that people are watching the news. Then there's the other question, which is if they are watching the news and they have noticed this story, they probably will forget it, or at least, you know, when roughly it happened. And which party you belong to, though, they probably guess it was the Tories. And by the way, that's because they had attached it to the narrative about the Tories being tired. And if it happened to somebody in the Labour Party, it probably wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't fit a narrative, so it would probably possibly create less attention. But I'm being more kind of insistent than you guys think. These things, people don't pay attention to them, even when we think they're remarkable. And even the friends of yours that you are saying paid attention to this, you don't normally pay attention to politics. Even those people are probably more than averagely interested in, you know, the news and public affairs in some very broad way.
It reminds me a little of the commentary that was made around when Mark Oaton got caught, a Liberal Democrat MP, got caught with, you know, scandals to do with paying for sex. And the commentary at the time said, why did you think that nobody would notice? You know, why did you think that this, you were so unimportant and of so little interest to the public eye that you could sort of do this kind of thing? I mean, yeah, it's extraordinary, really, the lack of status that our backbench MPs seem to think that they have. Of course you can't just go around doing this kind of thing when you're an elected member of parliament and expect to get away with it.
Yeah, it's a very, very interesting point, though, that, Polly. So, first of all, that is clearly an explanation for quite a lot of these things. Now, I do remember, you'll remember Peter Lord Sewell, who there was a big story about him in the paper. It was a sting involving a national newspaper and prostitutes, and the prostitutes asked him about devolution and some Sewell amendment, and it even at that point didn't twig to him that maybe it was a sting. And I think he was involved, you know, because it might seem a little bit unusual. The fact is that people who are members of Parliament or members of the House of Lords, you know, you go through almost all your life, nobody even recognises you, knows who you are, says anything to you, and therefore it doesn't occur to you that for certain respects, you're a public official who's famous, and therefore you do very careless things. I've seen this happen we've seen this happen loads of times.
But what about the 97 comparison and then Tory sleaze? Is that retrospectively seen as a thing that aided Labour and added to the Tories' downfall? Was it a part of the, it was part of the narrative in 97, wasn't it? That sleazy MPs, whether they were having affairs or taking money or up to no good, that was part of the what was going on, was it, Peter?
It was, but it wasn't part of our narrative. We didn't talk about it deliberately. Blair made it absolutely clear, you know, you leave well alone. But I mean, the media were all over it every day. I mean, every day there seemed to be something, some Tory MP propositioning somebody or other on some park bench in some part of the country. But I look, the public are, I think they sort of shrug. It's not a reason for bringing down a government, but it is a contributor to a narrative of a party that's lost the plot, that's sort of disintegrating, that is just turning in on itself, and heaven alone knows what's going to pop up next, and they just want to move on.
It's pure narrative, this, by the way. So this is about finding stories that conform to and amplifying stories that conform to the narrative that the Conservative Party is going off. There'll be more Tories than Labour, because there are more Tory MPs than Labour, just to start off with. And also, you know, it may be that there even are marginally more Tory scandals than Labour ones. But mostly it's about those stories about Tory scandals simply amplifying the narrative about the Conservative Party being in power for too long and sort of going off and being seedy, and those stories therefore become bigger ones. I mean, let's get this straight. That Mark Menzies story was Billy Kemper got was extraordinary, and it would have been, you know, huge story anyway. But these stories are amplified because they tell a story, and they become less important when they don't. You know, there have been Labour MPs who are standing down in various scandals, and it hasn't made much of a story because it doesn't contribute to something that we're all that interested so in think, the I story we're
that,
telling.
That, I mean, that's right. The way it sticks in people's mind is as part of a narrative that is built up. But this is a remarkably peculiar story and a situation for Mark Menzies to have got himself in. And I do think that whilst Peter's right in campaigning terms, nevertheless, Keir Starmer or any, you know, potentially incoming prime minister does need to think very deeply about how they will set standards and a culture of behaviour for their parliamentarians, partly to prevent kind of political risks, but also just to raise the standards of behaviour in public life. It now looks with huge numbers of members of parliament standing down, and the expected high turnover because of, you know, quite a big swing election, that we potentially have a huge new wave, probably one of the biggest waves of new parliamentarians next time. And so to think about how do you make that a sea change in behaviour, these are really difficult jobs. Lots of MPs work incredibly hard, 70, 80 hours a week. They are divided from their family. They are in this weird environment. I think, you know, thinking really carefully about how to treat them with care and compassion, as well as setting standards so that we can start to, we should go back to being horrified, I think, by a story like Mark Menzies.
Well, let's move on. We should point out that he, or a source close to Mark Menzies, said he offered to repay the money to this campaign fund, and he claims local Tories who controlled the account say he didn't need to, but somebody involved in that came forward, and they were the ones who approached the Times and said, we think campaign funds have been misused. But yes, absolutely. Let's move on, because up next we are going to talk about positioning for the leadership. There's a lot of it going on right now. Rwanda bill back in the Commons. And we know about Sarah Braverman and Robert Jenrick and all of that. Penny Mordaunt and Kemi Badenoch are not fighting over an ashtray, it seems, to position for the leadership as well. We'll do that next on How to Win an Election.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This episode of How to Win an Election is brought to you by Luton Rising, owners of London Luton Airport, the UK's most socially impactful airport. Find out more at lutonrising.org.uk.
Yes, it's How to Win an Election with me, Matt Chorley, still joined by Polly McKenzie, Peter Manderson and Daniel Finkelstein. Now, I wanted to talk about positioning for the leadership, because there's a lot of it going on, jockeying, particularly obviously in Tory ranks right now. People think about what might happen after the next election. We've had the Rwanda bill back in the Commons this week. When it first arrived, you had Suella Braverman and Robert Jenrick both complaining about it, saying they'd vote against it. That was seen as positioning for the leadership. Then on the smoking ban vote that we talked about earlier, Kemi Badenoch voted against it. Penny Mordaunt abstained. But then a source close to Penny Mordaunt told the BBC that she'd abstained because she wasn't a supporter of the bill. She's got objections to it, but she was, you know, wanted to look at the detail. But then she added, being a serving cabinet minister, she thought voting against it would look confrontational and posturing rather than more so than abstaining against it. So what is the art, Polly, do you think, of how do you posture? How do you get yourself in a good spot? You don't want to be the front runner because then everyone will come for you, but you don't want people to forget you exist. So what's the art of leadership posturing?
It's so tough. Basically, to get the timing right. I mean, the reality is huge numbers of members of parliament want to be the leader of their party because, you know, that's actually a really normal, healthy ambition. But it's like you're not allowed to say it because you always get into hot water. And so I think it's one of those things that just grates with normal people watching politics is anyone who's ever asked ends up sounding disingenuous and they do this sort of shy, coquettish blush and like, oh no, I could never do that. Like, oh, come on. The more you deny it, the more clear it is that that's what you want. And it just, if only we could have media reporting that didn't explode as I'm pretty sure that Nick Clegg accidentally said something at the, you know, some fringe event and upset Min Campbell when Min Campbell was the leader because he just said something normal. Like, sure, if there were a vacancy, I'd be interested. And suddenly it's like that's the only news story in town and it's ridiculous. Of course everyone wants to be a member of parliament. I mean, sorry, no, prime minister, that's the word. And I think the best way to do it in that context ends up being basically like using lots of proxies, a source close to, which is usually you, or if not, somebody who happens to share a parliamentary office with you.
I do. Your mentioning of Nick Clegg takes me straight back September 2007 and Nick Clegg being confronted outside the party conference by Elspeth, Lady Elspeth, the late wife of Min Campbell. And she said to him, I don't know if you're being helpful or not. And he said, I'm trying to be. And, you know, that gave us something that basically occupied us for the whole week. Peter, I suppose the obvious first question is, did you want to be prime minister?
It never, honestly, never occurred to me that I would become prime minister. Indeed, for most of my sort of early adulthood, I didn't think I'd even become a member of parliament. And that's, in a sense, why I went into the party headquarters. I thought I wanted to work for the party. I wanted to serve the party's interests. I wanted a career in politics. And that's why I became campaign director at a very early age. In the event, I thought I'd have one shot at becoming an MP. There were a variety of reasons why everyone pointed out to me that I was unlikely to be selected in Hartlepool in northeast England, but I thought I'd give it a go. Having done that and succeeded, it honestly never occurred to me that I would become leader. And I think one of the reasons here you've got to understand is that, you know, if you want to pitch for leader, it's as well to show leadership. And that doesn't always advance your interests in the party. Showing leadership means having ideas, having opinions, not sitting on the fence. And that can, result in you becoming a target in the party. It attracts opponents as well as support. And before you know where you are, you're accused of being divisive, you know, in the party. I'm very familiar with that. So, and I think that one of the sort of revolutions that have taken place in our parties, which has had a hugely detrimental effect on British politics, is the transfer of the power of election of our leaders from our members of parliament to our party activists and members. And the reason why I think that's had such a transformative and detrimental effect is that I think it's made people who aspire to be leader trim and tailor their views and what they do to the priorities, the preferences, the ideological prejudices of the party's base, as opposed to the general public. And, you know, I could just give you two solid recent examples of where this has potentially and then in reality led to calamity. One was the election by the Labour Party's members of Jeremy Corbyn, and the election by the Conservative members of Liz Truss. In both cases, in my view, the party did not fulfill their obligations to the nation, which was to find the best, most suitable person to lead our country. You know, we had these two, both these parties foist these two people on our country, and our country has been the loser as a result. And so I think that, frankly, if we want better politics and if we want our country better led and we don't want to take these risks either with our national security or our economy, it would be better to transfer the responsibility and the power of electing our leaders and prime ministers back to members of parliament who at least have the virtue of having been elected by the public. So in that sense, you're indirectly giving power back to the public over who should be prime minister.
I think you might have talked about this before, Danny, but the problem is, why on earth then would you join a political party if you don't even get to choose the leader?
Well, people did. I mean, people were, there were many more members of the Conservative Party, for example, before these elections were held. But let me just go back to this original question of positioning yourself for the leadership. First of all, there's always one of these things where people say you mustn't peak too early, which is one of my favourite phrases in politics. It's so ridiculous. I mean, most people don't peak at all, right? So, and you don't have much control, and you don't have much control about when you peak. When the Conservative Party was going to defeat in 1997, people said, "Well, don't peak too early," and I thought, "Well, chance would be certainly a fine thing." People position themselves all the time for a sense. So let's take an example of someone who's positioning themselves as a leader, setting out positions that are definitely designed to appeal to to right-wing national newspapers, and to show themselves as as bold in contrast to their leader, and that's Wes Streeting. Okay, so he's doing that. The reason I point that out is that, you know, that's all. The other way of looking at what Wes Streeting does is he's setting out an agenda for what he's intending to do. He's showing himself to be creative. He's providing a bit of small L leadership. And so, you know, you can look at this in two ways. I think it's certainly true that if you think the leader of the party is going to lose the next general election, you do gently begin to position yourself. And one of the best examples of that recently was Keir Starmer's position on Brexit, which shifted from his original position when he was appealing to sort of Corbyn and the Corbynites in order to be put in the shadow cabinet, to a position where he wanted to appeal to the people he thought he could make him leader. And, you know, there was mixed in that the fact that it probably was his genuine opinion. So I'm not being unduly cynical about it. It was all those things at once. But it goes on all the time in politics. It just becomes more interesting when you think there's going to be a vacancy.
Polly, was that basically what happened during the coalition years? The longer it went on and the polls didn't shift, that Vince Cable in particular just became a menace for Nick Clegg?
Well, there was lots of speculation about whether Nick would or should stand down before the election, stand down after the election. And there was both Vince Cable and then Tim Farron, who did go on to be the leader, clearly thinking about what their positioning would be, primarily with a sense of an appeal to the more left side of the party that was, you know, understandably uncomfortable with us being in coalition. But in the end, again, a strong leader can cope with that because there always will be a successor. And it's really just about holding your position for as long as you can. And you do that by maintaining strength. The challenge is when it becomes so obvious that either you're about to lose a general election or, frankly, that just the moves against you are so big. That's when a few rivals becomes sort of deeply, deeply problematic. Or if your leader just kind of is easily riled by someone. You know, David Cameron was constantly riled by Boris Johnson's clear ambitions. I think that actually affected sometimes his political judgment, because what you need is to just keep your enemies close, actually.
I suppose it only becomes interesting if the leader is vulnerable in some way. There's no problem with people posturing if the leader is, you know, high in the polls, because there's not an immediate thing there. Peter, take me back to that time when you were there, you'd come back to save Gordon Brown, and there were all those shenanigans. You had Jeff Hoon and Patricia Hewitt, then you had James Purnell resigned. Would David Miliband do it or not? The great white, for lots of people listening to us right now, they will still think, slightly oddly in my view, that politics would be better if David Miliband came riding in on a white horse. Take us back to that moment and how serious it actually was for Gordon Brown.
It was serious in the sense that there were quite a few members of the cabinet who were not happy about Gordon's performance, his strength of leadership, whether he was setting out an agenda to renew New Labour after those years of having been in power. There were people who felt, look, Gordon served a purpose, but he's not a very sort of front-footed, forward-looking. We're in need of fresh modernization, a new look. And that's why some people turned towards David Miliband. But the person who didn't turn towards David Miliband was David Miliband. And I mean, he wasn't sort of prepared to, you know, reach out and seize the crown. And certainly, as far as I was concerned, I wasn't prepared to seize the crown and put it into his hand. I'd already been badly burned and scarred by one leadership choice between Blair and Brown, 10 years before. I wasn't going to, you know, reinsert myself once again to be the meat in that particular sandwich. Most people think that had we made the leadership switch beforehand, and if David had been the new offer, then we would have been able to see off the Conservatives. I really don't know whether that is the case, but it didn't happen because there wasn't a candidate in David prepared to offer himself.
Danny?
Yeah, Peter makes draws attention to an interesting thing. Positioning yourself to be the leader is, as said, ubiquitous. You know, most MPs who have even the remotest chance, and some who don't even have that, are trying to position themselves to be the leader. A more difficult question is, how do you position yourself if you know that you're not going to be the next leader, but you want to work with the leader? How do you, at a very early stage, when you don't even know who exactly the candidates are, and you're not sure how it will play out, how do you build your alliances, position yourself with regard to one person or another? And Peter said, you know, he in the end felt he had a simple choice on the occasion with David Miliband, but a much more difficult choice when it came to Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. And it was interesting because you worked with both of them, Peter, it was then very late in the day when you were finally pushed into having to choose between them. And obviously it came about in tragic circumstances, so it hadn't come earlier. So, and it then became acute. And I think people do find themselves in that position. So I think that's a more difficult positioning one than positioning yourself to run for the leadership.
Positioning to yourself around the people who might run for the leadership. Polly, what do you think is the equivalent of the old Michael Portillo installing the phone lines for an abortive leadership? Is it buying a web address? Is there something even more, but that people are getting it sort of slightly ahead of themselves?
Yeah, and you do, people again make an excuse that it was just my uncontrollable supporters who loved me so much that they went out and registered something. I think it is important to have your allies and your friends, people you have deeply thought about things with, but actually the operational planning is much better. You can pull that together unbelievably quickly. And if, you know, whatever, polly4pm.com is missing, just come up with a different slogan. It's like, it's not that hard. I think the most important thing Peter has said is that, you know, in the end, it comes down to leadership, to actually setting out positions because you believe in them, because you have an agenda. My heart says, you know, you want the Alexander Hamiltons and not the Aaron Burrs. And if you haven't watched the musical, just watch it, because then you'll understand what I'm talking about. But in the end, neither of those tactics work. If you always say what you believe, you often get yourself into trouble. But if you never say what you believe, then you don't deserve to be leader and people will see through you. So you have to find a course somewhere in the middle. And I don't know what that is. Alexander Burr, that's the answer.
There's another factor here, and it's going to arise in the case of Rishi Sunak if there's a great turmoil in the Conservative Party and people turn against him and think, well, he's just a loser. He's not going to be able to carry us through this final length. You know, let's get him out and get somebody else in who might do it better. And I always remember, you know, you're asking me about Gordon and David Miliband. And on a fateful day when Patricia Hewitt and Jeff Hoon made their move against Gordon, futile, to disintegrated within minutes. But I remember talking to Alistair Darling about it, the late Alistair Darling, and I said, look, what are your wishes here? What are your intentions here? And he said, frankly, I can see the case for change. I can see the case for David Miliband, but I can also see the case for not making this move, because there'll be blood all over the walls. You know, not easily persuade Gordon to stand down. All the people around him, all his Praetorian guard, there'll be mayhem and there'll be bullets flying in all directions. And we simply can't afford that noise, that disarray, that blood all over all those walls so soon, you know, ahead of the coming election. And I think that's a dilemma that people are going to be faced within the Conservative Party as well, if there are some people who think that Sunak needs to be challenged and replaced. There'll be plenty of others, I suspect the majority, who will say, don't be so ridiculous. We can't afford that at this stage in the game. The public will think, just throw their hands up in complete despair. So we've just got to stick with the guy we have and cross our fingers and hope for the best.
It's interesting that even if there was a candidate who might do better, the act of changing them, and that's not without its risks and its impact. While you were talking there, Peter, I've checked. We can buy polly4pm.com. for £6.84 for the first year. But if it's going to be a longer campaign, it is going to go up to £18.84 in the second year. So we need to know when you're going to move, Polly. Do we want it for just a year, or
stages I might need to get through first. But of course, like Peter, I have the initials PM already. So maybe, in fact, Peter and I could have a joint candidacy. PM, PM, PM.
PM for PM. Now, I want to ask, because this is one of our recurring themes on the podcast, is when is the election going to be? It's a question that we asked ourselves when we began. Well, we've had this question in. Simon has sent this question into How to Win an Election.
In choosing the date of the general election, would Rishi Sunak be best to announce the date just before the Labour Party conference or at the end of the Conservative Party conference? In answering this question, will this further give us clearer indications of when the election will actually be? Thank you.
So I'm sure we've all had the email from the Tories inviting us to apply to attend the party conference. Interestingly, they don't. I'm not sure if they're charging the media in the same way, which suggests they're not quite so diligently organising their party conference as they have done in previous years. What would be your advice, Danny? Because the party conference is a sort of a big lump in the political calendar, which has two advantages. You raise lots of money from it, and you get loads of blanket coverage. So it is a thing in the run-up to an election. So before Labour, after the end of the Tories, or just ignore it altogether?
Yeah, I think the impact of the coverage, as you would expect me to say, is overestimated. no, I mean, it is. People don't follow that it's your conference and it's like item four on the news. But you do get one big go for the leader's speech, and that, I think, does have an impact. You know, for one day, I don't think it moves hugely, but you can establish a strategy, you can capture the media, so it's worth a bit. I think that the media, the broadcasters in particular, who matter a lot, will be doing their very best to ensure they don't have a complete sort of imbalance of coverage at that period. So it probably wouldn't change anything to move the conference around. The Conservative Party might worry, by the way, that if it held the conference, it wouldn't necessarily get the sort of unity that it hoped for. Nigel Farage and Liz Truss can turn up, and with the narrative against the Conservatives, it may not be the kind of triumphant occasion you actually look for. So I'm not sure in the end that you should spend an awful lot of time worrying about it, because I don't think it's going to move the dial.
I think you have to spend time worrying about it. Just the sheer mention of Nigel Farage reveals why it would be a bad idea. If they're going on this timeline, they're heading straight into the middle of the US presidential election. I'd put my money on Trump just off the back of his top of his head, just issuing an endorsement for Nigel Farage in the British general election. Is that what Rishi Sunak wants? Is that what the Conservative Party needs? I'd say no. I'd avoid any overlap with the US presidential election like the plague.
So what, call the election like beginning of September and it's all done and dusted by early October?
Or end of August, it may have to be.
I think you either want to go before both conferences or after both conferences. And as Peter says, that puts you into the US general election. So in the end, that takes you back to January. I think the conferences are a huge risk. The unity moment won't happen because huge numbers of MPs who really care about their seat will be in their seat fighting. They don't want to go hang about at a conference centre for 3 days, like what, eating chicken goujons and drinking warm white wine. No, they want to be campaigning if they care. And
chicken goujons.
Sorry.
That's
no, there's occasionally prawn goujons at the Tory party conference. But
oh, I think I'd steer clear of the prawns.
I think Danny's wrong, actually, that the this question of it being a regulated period, once you've announced the general election, once you've called the election, becomes a regulated period. And I think the broadcasters have to be much stricter about the balance of coverage. I think the Conservatives, if they let Labour have a conference, need that. It's marginal benefit, but nonetheless, that big day of their own, for it to still not be a regulated period. I do think that some of them believe that a Trump victory is the only card that gives them a chance actually to boost their result, because, you know, there is some polling to suggest that people think Rishi Sunak would be a better prime minister for dealing with Donald Trump, and or not a better prime minister on really any other measures. And so, you know, again, but maybe I'm just sort of trying to convince myself that I was right, however many months ago it was. I do still think there is a chance of January. And if it is not late August, early September that they announce, I will become really convinced that January is the day.
Please, please don't do that to the country. Don't give us January, for goodness sake.
It's not me, Peter. It's not me.
Let's all...
It's not going to be in January.
Peter's already booked his Christmas holiday.
I can't bear the thought of it. I'm just going to go off and have a nice plate of goujon somewhere. I'm sorry. Bye-bye.
Very good. Well, there we are. I'm glad that we've basically all sort of settled down where we were before. You'll be pleased to know we've also had to... thank you to Simon for sending that in. We've had some more correspondence as well. It's a different Simon, I think, has sent us some more poetry. Do you remember we were doing poetry? Here we are. So this is Simon in West Sussex. Polly, Peter, Danny and Matt keep us amused with their erudite chat. Whatever is said, though it might make us smile, Danny regrets that it won't move the dial.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Good.
Best thing on the podcast today. Well, thank you so much. If you want us to get in touch with your own questions, send us a voice note to 033-003-2353. You can email howtowin@thetimes.co.uk if you've got questions for Polly, Peter, Danny and me. That was How to Win an Election.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.